Good morning, everyone. Judge Sykes and I are very honored to be joined this morning by Judge Phil Simon from the United States District Court of Northern District of Indiana. He's sitting by designation on the six cases that we will hear today. And the first case up is Donna Lewis versus the Chicago Police Department, appeal number 08-2877. Ms. Kearns.
May it please the court, counsel. Dana L. Kurtz appearing on behalf of Donna Lewis, the appellant in this case. We are requesting that this court reverse the judgment of the district court and remand this case for a new trial. There are two main points that I would like to make this morning to the court. First, the jury instructions given in this case required Ms. Lewis to prove both gender discrimination and retaliation. Secondly, to compound this error, the district court excluded the consequences of Williams reassigning her on March 13th, and effectively, the defendants were allowed to argue that she was never injured on any call while Ms. Lewis was barred from presenting any evidence that she was injured at all. Turning to the first point, the jury instructions in this case required the jury to find both gender discrimination and retaliation. This court has repeatedly reversed district courts when jury instructions are in error. In the case of Dawson versus New York Life, when there was a possibility that the jury based its decision on incorrect law, Aliotto versus National Railroad Passenger Corporation, Huff versus Sheehan, Byrd versus Illinois Department of Public Health, Humphrey versus Stazak, United States versus Folly, DeBout versus Norfolk, and Boyd versus Illinois State Police. In all of those cases, the jury instructions were far less in error than those instructions given in this case. Looking at the jury instructions as a whole, there are at least five places in the jury instructions that required the jury to find both gender discrimination and retaliation.
You talk a little bit about the facts here, but how many female officers applied to participate in this program?
Throughout the city of Chicago for the IMF conference, there were numerous. In the 3rd District, Officer Donna Lewis requested that her sergeant put her name on the list. Officer Jackie Regan was also available to attend and met the requirements.
There were 17 women that were selected for this particular duty. I don't know how many applied. If you know, maybe we don't know that.
In terms of the number of applied, we don't know. We know in the 3rd District, Officer Donna Lewis was the only female. She was the only female that was not allowed to attend.
Were any other women police officers in Chicago? Were there any other claims made of discrimination by any of them who applied and were not selected?
No, and there were no other women, based upon what we know in the record, that applied and whose names were taken off the list. In fact, there were two male officers that did not meet the qualifications and were allowed to attend this IMF conference. And that brings us to the point of this is not a case where there was no evidence. There was plenty of evidence in this case. This is not a case where the jury made credibility determinations. In this case,
they did, because the jury had to decide whether she was telling the truth or Williams was telling the truth about the conversation they allegedly had about how dangerous this was and that we don't want you to go.
Well, and with respect to...
There was a diametrically opposed bit of testimony between the lieutenant and her.
Correct. And in fact, Lieutenant Williams at trial testified he didn't remember the conversation. He couldn't remember if he told her those things at all.
I thought he denied it.
He initially denied it in his deposition, and he was impeached at trial because also in his deposition he said he didn't remember. And he didn't remember the things that he told her. He couldn't remember if, in fact, he had told her that that it was because she was a female or about him being discriminated against going up through the department. In this case, though, the jury instructions is what is in error, at least in the first
part. Can we get specific on that?
Yes.
One of the things you claim is your concern about this stray also, and it seems pretty clear Judge Castillo switched the paragraphs and inadvertently didn't delete the also from the first paragraph. And then there's a use of the and when he's summarizing and focusing the jury's attention on, you know, don't be concerned about whether you like the decisions the city made. These are the things you have to be concerned with, whether there was retaliation and gender discrimination. My question is, did you object to the jury instructions that were tendered?
Yes. The plaintiff, on numerous occasions, the plaintiff objected to the jury instructions.
To the use of the word also?
Not to the word also, because that was done after. Pursuant to Rule 51, there was no opportunity to object to that before, and that was done after the instructions were read to the jury.
As I understand it, you came into court that morning. Your opposing counsel offered a change to the instructions, and according to the transcript, tendered those to the court. Did you see those instructions?
No, Your Honor. The plaintiff had not, we had not seen those instructions and did not know how it was phrased until the instructions were already read to the jury. And
you didn't ask, can I see a copy of what's being tendered to the court?
Your Honor, we had already exchanged drafts, and that word also, because the court made that change after it was submitted by the defendant. So neither side saw the word also in the instructions that were read. And that's not the only error. Even if that was the only error, maybe, possibly, but you have to look at the instruction, because the instruction talks about, because she complained, it goes on and then says, because she complained about gender discrimination, plaintiff must also prove. That's in instruction number 4. The very next instruction has and. And if you look at the pattern Seventh Circuit instructions, there is no and. There are brackets. It is intended to be an or situation if there is someone claiming discrimination or retaliation. In addition to that, the materially adverse action language appears in both instruction number 2 and instruction number 4. There is no separate definition. We argue in the material adverse action language in the retaliation instruction is error as a matter of law based
upon... Did you object to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. And that is an error as a matter of law under the Supreme Court and under this court's decision in Lewis and subsequent decisions after White. So you have the materially adverse action language in both instructions, and then you have the reading of the verdict forms. Now, Appelli argues in this case, well, this error was cleared by the verdict forms that were read. The trial transcript, page 1028 to 1030, where the district court is reading the verdict forms. Finally, verdict form 4 says, we, the jury, find that the plaintiff, Donna Lewis, has not proved by a preponderance of the evidence that she was subjected to retaliation in violation of federal law. And that is, if you find for defendant Williams on the claim of gender discrimination, this is the verdict form to sign. He goes on. As to the second claim of retaliation, which is brought only against the city of Chicago, the verdict forms are basically the same. I don't really need to read them. There is one verdict form if you find for plaintiff Lewis. There is one verdict form if you find in favor of the city of Chicago. So you have these errors in the jury instructions that are compounded. And clearly, at least a possibility under this court's decision in Dawson and other decisions, there's a possibility that the jury in this case determined that they had to find both, requiring a reversal of the district court's judgment and a new trial in this case.
Well, I'm sure that I haven't seen the closing arguments in the case, but I'm relatively certain that you argued to the jury that you don't have to find both. That the jury did not have to find both discrimination and retaliation in order to find in your favor. It could find either one.
That argument was not made in closing, and here's why. Because the closing arguments were done before the jury instructions were read to the jury.
Might very well be, but I just can't imagine this case has been tried, and I haven't seen what was said during the opening statements, closing arguments, and so on, but that lawyers would not say, there's two claims, they're separate. You can find for the plaintiff on one or both, and I mean, that's the way these kind of cases are normally presented and tried, and why would this case have been presented any differently?
Well, and certainly in closing argument, we argued that there was gender discrimination claim and a retaliation claim. However, as this court is aware, closing arguments are not the law. What the judge reads and the judges say, and judge the district court said in this case, you are to follow the law. What an attorney argues in opening or closing is not what you are to follow. It is argument. That does not fix the error in this case. It is the jury instructions. And to compound that error in this case, the plaintiff was barred from presenting any evidence that she was injured. While the defendants asked for the September 2002 incident, were you injured? No. For the October 4th, 2002 incident, were you injured? No. Never asking about whether she was injured on March 13th. And in fact, in closing, at page 999 of the trial transcript, the defendants took this advantage of the district court barring all of this evidence and argued, quote, with respect to the March 13th incident, what was so dangerous about this narcotics call anyway? We don't know. What was so dangerous? I don't think the evidence adds up. They argued that she was irrational, that she was paranoid, that she was delusional, that there was, they inferred from the lack of evidence, from the fact that we were barred from presenting evidence, that there was no injury. And therefore, as this court held in Lewis, the alleged retaliation included sending Lewis on dangerous assignments, leading her to believe that Williams was trying to place her in compromising and dangerous situations. The plaintiff in this case, Ms. Lewis, was not allowed to present that evidence. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Officer Lewis received a full and fair trial during which she presented the testimony of a dozen witnesses over the course of 7 days. The jury considered this evidence and rendered a verdict for the defendants. This verdict should stand. This morning I'd like to address the 2 points that counsel addressed, beginning with the confusion over the words and also in the jury instructions, and then moving on to the exclusion of the March 13th incident. With regard to the placement of the words and also in the jury instructions, the argument here is simply that she takes issue with two particular words over the course of numerous pages of jury instructions. Now, she indicates that the case law supports overturning the jury verdict in this situation and ordering a new trial, but in fact, none of the cases come anywhere near rising to that level. And in fact, if you look at the main case that she cites in her brief, Huff, and then the main case she cites in her reply brief, Wilk, both of those cases deal with situations in which the jury instructions were plainly incorrect statements of the law, not where you have the problem of confusion coming in. Wilk actually deals with both an incorrect statement of the law and confusion, but actually there the confusion relates to a 9-paragraph instruction on an antitrust case, which is normally given in only 1 paragraph. And obviously the difference between 2 individual words versus a 9-paragraph problem is clearly distinguishable on that grounds. In fact, this case is much closer to Hefferman, which we cite in our brief, and there you can see a similar type of discrepancy where an instruction omits just a single claim once, but otherwise consistently sets forth the correct standard of the law. And there, Hefferman instructs that the court was permitted to look at the entire course of trial, the opening statements, the closing statements, the content of the jury instructions, and the jury verdict forms to determine whether or not the jury was properly informed of the law. And here the case is the same. Ms. Officer Lewis points to numerous parts of the instruction that she believes were incorrect, but at the end of the day, the jury verdict forms, the forms that were handed to the jury, that they took back with them into the deliberations, that they had to fill out and sign, those forms correctly stated what the claims were, did not cross-reference each other, and certainly did not state that it was a prerequisite to find discrimination in order to find retaliation.
Well, of course, the jury had a copy of the instructions as well.
It did. And with regard to that, the only issues that she's raised in the instructions, the first regards the word placement of the word also in the discrimination instruction, and I think a clear reading of that would indicate that the also is a reference to the preponderance of the evidence standard if you were to read it, if you were to focus in on that word and what it could be referring to.
And that stray also appeared several pages in the instructions after the elements of the discrimination claim were stated?
That's correct. That's correct. I also think it's worth noting there was some...
Can you tell me how that came about? I really can't understand from reading the transcript. How did it develop?
Sure. This was in the retaliation instruction, and the way that the defendants had worded it, they started with the materially adverse standard and then went down to discuss what the different allegations were. And the judge indicated when the instruction was proposed that he would rather see those occur in a different order, that the instruction begin with the recitation of the allegations and then the second paragraph be the paragraph concerning the materially adverse standard. And when he indicated that he was making that change, he actually did tell counsel verbally, this is what I'm going to do. The only change I'm going to make is to admit to remove the words first and second at the beginning of those paragraphs. So if you were paying attention, when he announced that he was making that change, it would be clear that the also was getting moved to the wrong place. But even if it wasn't, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 51C requires that counsel object promptly after learning of the error. So even if, as counsel claims, she wasn't aware of the error beforehand, she certainly was aware of the error after the instructions had been read. And at that point in time, there was actually a very convenient spot to alert the court to that because the defendants had already raised a problem with one of the verdict forms. And so the jury had just retired to get lunch and had not yet selected a foreperson. So there was...
Did the court give counsel a copy of the written instructions before they were read to the jury?
Not to my knowledge. I don't actually know the answer to that.
With this change?
Right. This was a last-minute change, I think, on the morning they were read.
Well, typically the counsel would get a copy of the written instructions at the same time the jury did. Well, maybe that's not the typical case, but that ought to be the typical case.
Yeah, I know that there was a final set of written instructions that contains this, and at what point that was transmitted to counsel, I just don't know the answer to that.
Well, the judge apparently forgot to give all the general instructions as well.
That is correct. There was...
Were they requested?
No party requested the general instructions, and again, there was no objection after the fact. Now, there's some discrepancy in the standing order whether or not these instructions are presumably given, although you can take a look and see that they include instructions on... expert witnesses, when deposition testimony is appropriate, different types of compensatory damages. So it's apparent when you look at them that not all instructions are going to be relevant in all trials.
But the missing witness instruction would be one that would be germane here and wasn't given, right?
Well, now there's two instructions. And a pattern instruction like Seventh Circuit Pattern Jury Instruction 1.18, saying that a party is not required to call all their witnesses, that simply wasn't part of Judge Castillo's general jury instructions. The one that Your Honor might be referring to is one that indicates that a single witness could be sufficient on any point of issue.
What about burden of proof?
Say that again?
Burden of proof?
The burden of proof. That was included in Judge Castillo's general jury instructions, although the actual instructions given to the jury stated multiple times that the burden of proof was preponderance of the evidence.
But the jury didn't get a definition of what that meant.
That's correct.
Which is a problem.
Here our position would be that the jury was informed of what the standard was.
Well, the jury was told that the standard was a preponderance, but it wasn't told what that meant.
Correct.
There's
never been an argument raised that the jury would have misunderstood what that means. We'd certainly be happy to submit something on that if the court would like.
What about the motivating factor jury instruction here? It's kind of an open question, and maybe we don't have this issue squarely presented in this case, but there's kind of an open question about whether but-for causation is required in all discrimination cases or just mixed motive cases under the Desert Palace case, and this was not a mixed motive case, so maybe we don't have that squarely framed here. And as I understand it, the motivating factor instruction that the plaintiff requested was essentially a but-for causation instruction anyway, although it was phrased differently than the pattern instruction. But, I mean, that is a legal issue that's a little bit unclear.
As Your Honor pointed out, first and foremost, this case simply wasn't presented as a motivating factor case. At no point in time did Officer Lewis contend that the defendant acted in part based on a legitimate
motive. Well, why couldn't a memo inject that issue into the case? I mean, the memo is pretty explicit that if you're a woman and there's an odd number, you need not apply. And so why is it the defendant's choice under Boyd to raise the mixed motive issue? Why shouldn't that just as likely be the plaintiff's choice if it's reasonably raised by the evidence? And if they want to go for half a loaf instead of the full loaf, why ought they not have the choice to do that?
Certainly, I think
and
we would
three other circuits allow that, correct?
I'm not sure what you mean by allow, but let me address your first point, which is we would agree entirely that the plaintiff could have elected to argue a mixed motive here. But with regard to the memo, the plaintiff's position at trial was actually that the memo was fabricated as an after-the-fact justification for the decision not to let her participate in the IMF detail. So I would certainly agree that had she approached it and said the memo was legitimate, the policy was legitimate, we just think there was multiple factors going on here, that might have been an approach she could take.
That would be a not particularly clever way to cover things up by saying that gender, if you're a woman, you need not apply. Is that what their argument was at trial? That this memo was some kind of after-the-fact justification?
Yes, they argued in opening statement and during trial that the memo was a fabrication, and the basis of that was a fax line that appeared across the top of the memo, and it had a date on it that was different from the date that the memo was created. Somebody faxed it after it was created. Not too hard to imagine, but that they used that as the basis for the theory that the memo was actually a fabrication and not created on September 11th, 2002, or whatever the actual date in question was. So in this particular case, there just wasn't any point where the plaintiff was arguing anything that resembled a mixed motive, anything that resembled
But they submitted a jury instruction asking for it, so and it's reasonably raised by the evidence.
We would disagree that it's reasonably raised by the evidence here. In addition to rejecting the memo, the legitimacy of the memo, the other main piece of evidence on discrimination was this he said, she said argument about did he say that she couldn't go because the assignment was too dangerous for women, or did he say she couldn't go because of this gender-neutral hotel policy? So it's our position that the evidence, the jury would either believe him or her, but there wasn't evidence submitted on some sort of a compromise position.
Well, in the jury instruction requested by the plaintiff on this motivating factor issue, asked the jury to be instructed that her gender, the plaintiff's gender, made a difference in the decision, which is essentially but-for causation, not contributing factor causation. So it essentially is just a different way of saying the same thing as the current pattern motivating factor instruction on discrimination cases, setting aside the mixed motive issue.
Right, in which case then it's hard to tell what exactly the prejudice is that the plaintiff is facing on that, in addition to the tendered instruction being incorrect, or the proposed instruction being incorrect and not addressing the defendant's ability to come back with an affirmative defense, saying that the decision would have been the same regardless. I wanted to briefly address the March 13th injury. I know she raised an issue on opening the door, and I would point out that during trial that was a very discreet cross-examination question concerning the October 4th incident, and it just recounted what happened during that incident, that they responded to a shots fired call. There were already officers there. There was no suspect. No suspect was ever found. And then the final question in that line was, were you injured at all in the course of this? And she said no, and that was a discreet and thus doesn't fall under the opening the door rule because it was regarding a different incident and didn't create a misimpression on the issues. I would also point out that all the evidence showed that the incident was actually an accident. It wasn't something that was done intentionally against Officer Lewis. There was a lot of discrepancy as to whether Lieutenant Williams was actually involved in this incident, and in fact it was the order to respond to it was directly verified by Sergeant Good, an independent person who's not been accused of discrimination or retaliation here.
Did you argue that these narcotics calls are not, in fact, dangerous?
Say that again?
Did you argue in closing that these calls aren't dangerous?
I don't think we argued in general that these calls aren't dangerous. Okay. The question that came up during trial was she was in the progress in the course of responding to a robbery in progress, and she was diverted to assist the narcotics team in the drug raid. And so Officer Lewis had argued this shows that Lieutenant Williams, you know, to the extent he was involved in this, was trying to throw me in harm's way. And in closing argument, we pointed out that responding to a robbery in progress is, you know, potentially just as dangerous as participating in a drug raid with eight other narcotics officers. So that was the intention of what was going on at closing argument.
But is it true, as counsel suggested, that in closing argument there's this repeated drumbeat of she went after call and wasn't harmed, and yet wasn't allowed to introduce the evidence on the one where she was, in fact, harmed?
The only place that came up during trial was the single cross-examination question on the October 4th incident. Then during closing arguments, there was a mention of the September 30th CAPS complaint and, again, the October 4th shots fired call. So those were the only mentions of it throughout the entire course of trial. And, in fact, the notion that the jury didn't know she was injured on the job is false. I believe during the cross-examination of several of Officer Lewis's witnesses, counsel asked, were you aware that Officer Lewis was suffered an on-the-job injury? So it was apparent, I believe it came up, on-the-job injury during the spring of 2003. So the jury did know, in fact, that she had been injured. It wasn't a mystery that something had happened to her on a different call that wasn't being identified in the September 30th or October 4th incidents. I see my time is up, so I'll just briefly conclude. Officer Lewis was given a full and fair jury trial, and the jury elected to find against her. Nothing that she raises here rises to a level necessary to overturn that verdict. For these reasons and the reasons articulated in our brief, we would urge the court to affirm.
May it please the court. In response to Appelli's argument in terms of Hefferman, I asked the court to actually look at Hefferman, and in fact, in Hefferman, there were two claims, an FLSA claim as well as a race discrimination claim. And on the jury instruction with respect to the race discrimination claim, this court noted that the instruction actually says first that he was fired from his basketball coaching position at Malcolm X or that he was denied a physical education teaching position, and second, that his race was a substantial or motivating factor that prompted the City Colleges of Chicago to fire him or deny him the physical education teaching position. There were at least three places in that instruction on the race discrimination claim that the jury instructions referenced or. So, in fact, Hefferman actually supports Ms. Lewis's position in this case that the jury instructions here are in error and that the jury possibly could have and, in fact, did require her to prove both gender discrimination and retaliation.
What about Ms. Bach's point that there was an early opportunity to raise an objection and it wasn't?
With respect to the jury instructions themselves, there were numerous objections. And this court asked counsel with respect to the also. In fact, the district court did not provide copies of those instructions before they were read. And if the court looks at the trial transcript with respect to when after the jury instructions were read, after the jury already went to deliberate, defense counsel brought up that there was a typographical error in one of the verdict forms in which Judge Castillo said that he would correct that error. He did not recall the jury. There were already numerous other errors in the record, not only the also, but the and, the materially adverse action, the reading of the verdict form, in fact, and the general instructions not being read. And not only did the jury not get instructed on what the preponderance of the evidence means.
Why is that necessary?
Because
no, we don't instruct in criminal cases, we don't instruct the jury on what reasonable doubt means.
In civil cases, there is an instruction on the preponderance of the evidence because lay people don't understand what that means. And typically the reason that that explanation is given is because the average lay person has the concept of criminal cases and what the burden of proof is in a criminal case, which is very different in a civil case. The jury also was not instructed on what direct and circumstantial evidence is, which is contained in the general instructions, or on the witnesses, which was also contained in the general instructions. In fact, I received an email from defense counsel as we were exchanging instructions that in addition to Judge Castillo's general instructions, here are the instructions we are proposing. Both sides expected, based upon his standing order, that those instructions would be given. Again, it compounds the error in this case.
That's done by email?
I'm sorry?
That's done by email? That's not done by pleadings?
With respect to the changing of the jury instructions, yes, so that the parties can see what the other side is going to present as jury instructions so that we can make our objections and then ultimately present those to the extent that the jury instructions can't be worked out.
I don't understand that. You got a copy of the court's final instructions prior to the instruction conference, correct?
No.
So while you were having the dialogue with the court on the instructions, you weren't given them at all? The court's final instructions?
No, not until they were read. And I see my time has expired.
Well, you just said a moment ago you didn't even get them at the time they were read. Did you get the written instructions at the time they were read?
At the time they were read, they were passed out to the attorneys for both sides at the time that they were read by the court. Prior to them being read, the parties were not given a copy of the final instructions with the phrase also included in there.
To approve before they were read?
Correct. I thank the court for its time. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.